In this lecture, we're going to try to develop a formula that will tell us how fast a company can grow. We're going to answer the question, is there a limit to how fast a company can grow? Remember that what we develop will not be the guarantee of growth, it will simply be the limit of growth. Now, in the previous session, we developed a formula that stated that, the DuPont formula, that stated that return on assets and leverage, and the return on assets in turn could be factored into profit after tax over sales times turnover. And we put all that together and we said we came up with a factor we called return on equity, and that's one of the things the shareholders want. But it turns out that's not all that they want. The shareholders expect more than a return on their equity. They expect the company to do other good things. We've already sort of alluded to it. Other good things include dividends. And other good things on top of that include that the share should go up in value. And still other good things include that the company ought to grow. But of course, that's really another way of saying they're hoping the shares will go up in value, because if the company grows, it's usually because earnings grow. And if earnings grow, the shares will go up in value. Unfortunately, what the shareholders are demanding for the most part is a trade-off. Because if we pay dividends, we know we limit growth. And so you can't have it all, but the shareholders expect it all. And so what we have to do is to take a look at the important decisions that directors make that influence the ability of the company to grow. Remember that if we pay dividends, we do limit growth, and we said that the only reason we pay dividends are that there are some people, let's call them widows and orphans, just to be politically correct, who need the money to live on, or old folks. However, we suggested, well, then if you need the money to live on, why don't you just sell a few shares? But we know you don't touch the principal. That's an old British idea. And we said we really pay dividends to satisfy fiduciaries, that is, trust officers and mutual fund managers, who are by law restrained to be prudent men, George Putnam's term, not mine, meaning that they would behave like a prudent man, which means they would invest other people's money in the way they would invest their own, and that therefore they should invest in good, solid earning stocks, not betting that they'll earn something 20 years from now. And so if we do pay a dividend, we qualify for inclusion in their portfolios, which means more people want to own our stock, and if more people want to own our stock, the stock will go up in value, and that'll make everybody happy. So maybe it's okay to pay a dividend after all, as long as we don't get carried away and pay too much of it. The trouble with paying a dividend is once you commit yourself, it's an awfully bad signal if you ever cut it, especially if you cut it to zero. The market will climb all over you, and your shares will be worth practically nil in no time. Well, we've said the shareholders want things. They want growth. And what does it take to grow? Well, clearly you have to have good ideas. You know, investing in something that's not a growing business is not likely to get you growth. There are some things that are almost inevitable. You know, I made a rather nice fortune just paying attention to what the war babies did. In fact, I once put it to a group, I'll put it to you. How do you make a lot of money knowing there were a bunch of war babies around, born in the period, let's say, between 45 and 55? Here's the rules. You only get to invest once every 5 years. Whatever industry you choose, you have to invest in an industry, or in the largest company in that industry that's public. Okay? So the babies were born between 45 and 55, so we'll say on average it's 1950. So it's 1950. What business or what industry could we invest in that would get us the purest investment in a big play of the fact that there's a lot of babies around? Well, almost every group, when they think about it a while, says, eh, hell, baby food. So, okay, you just bought Gerber's for 5 years. At the end of 5 years, it's 1955, the babies are now 5 years old. Where do we go in the growth? Well, if you think about it a while, five-year-olds need toys. So you cast around, the biggest toy manufacturer that was public at the time was Mattel. So you sell all your Gerber and you buy Mattel and you hang on to that for 5 years. Now the kids are 10 years old. What are we going to get them? Everybody always says bicycles, but I couldn't find the biggest bicycle manufacturer, I guess, was Schwinn, but they weren't public. The only bike manufacturer I could find was AMF. They also made pin spotters. Well, when people were having all those kids, they didn't have anything else to do but bowl at night anyway. So you buy AMF for 5 years. And then I cheated. At age 15, the thing that's significant that you have to recognize is that the definition of a pedestrian is a married man with two cars and a 16-year-old kid. The wife needs one of them to chauffeur the younger kids around, and the 16-year-old steals the family car, so the old man has to join a commuter pool. The important thing, though, is that there's a huge demand for automobiles, so let's buy General Motors for 5 years. It gets a little harder when the kids get to be 20, because about all you know for sure is they go away somewhere. They may go away to school, they may go away to the army, they may go away and get married. There's a Jewish expression that life begins when the last kid leaves home, the dog dies. But they go away, which means, of course, they establish their own household, so maybe you ought to buy white goods, buy people who make refrigerators or something. But we'll cut it off after 15 years. That meant we bought baby food, toys, bicycles, and automobiles. Now, it was pretty hard to be wrong in the market in that period. In that 20-year period, I suppose you, just if you'd bought the Dow Jones average, you would have made 5 times your investment. But this would have made you 22 times your investment. Lest you think you're too smart, you should have stayed in Gerber the whole time, because the baby boom, babies continued. More significantly, they discovered that old folks were buying baby food. And they thought, oh, old folks are taking it home and gumming it. Well, it's a possibility. So they decided they would market a geriatric food. Of course, it bombed. Because had they done a little market research and asked those old folks what they were buying it for, they'd all lie and say they're taking it home for their grandchildren. None of them are going to admit they're taking home food home to gum. So it's coming back again, though. You'll notice there are all sorts of adult formulas being served. Well, the point is that demographics generate ideas a mile a minute. The electronics age generates ideas a mile a minute. This stuff is all new. You know, we didn't have videotaped lectures 20 years ago. Maybe we were better off without them, for all I know. But we didn't have them. And so opportunities arise all the time. The question is, can you make money at it? Well, to make money at it, first of all, you have to have capital to invest. You have to have some kind of sense about how to implement it in a timely manner. And being first is often helpful, because in case of a consumer product, you grab market share and shelf space before the other guy gets there. There is a risk in being first. The old saying that you can tell the pioneers they have arrows in their back. There is a risk to being first, because you don't know how fast the market will develop, and you could starve to death while you were waiting for it to develop. So the number one guy isn't necessarily the most successful, and that's so in almost every industry. You usually require a lot of assets, both fixed and assets and current assets. The current assets are fairly easy to come by, because usually you can disinvest in a hurry if you have to, because by definition they're current, they turn back into cash in a year. The fixed assets, unfortunately, don't convert that quickly, and so if you commit yourself to fixed assets too early, you could get in big trouble if the market doesn't develop at the rate you thought it would, because there's a fixed asset that's not operating at full capacity, and we know from previous lectures that when you have fixed assets, the name of the game is to keep them busy. So the commitment to fixed assets ought to be piecemeal, but then you'd be violating Mr. Lange's rules. He says build everything big in the first place in order to get that favorable Lange effect of large scale. So you're sort of juggling 6 balls in the air at one time, and if you're one-handed like me, I'm not ambidextrous, that's kind of a hard trick. But put all of that together, this question still arises, is even if you have all these great ideas and know how to implement it, can you finance it? Does financing limit the ability of a business to grow? And with that in mind, I'd like to try to develop a formula that would say how fast a business can grow. To do that, we have to make a couple of assumptions, both of which are sort of reasonable, but they have their limitations and they're worth discussing. The first one is that a well-run company maintains a fairly constant turnover ratio. That is, the ratio of sales to assets remains fairly constant. Another way of saying that is that the only way that sales can increase is for assets to increase. The reason that turnover ratio remains fairly constant is we're really saying that a well-run company does not have assets that are idle. They're not lying around. The plant isn't operating at 30% of capacity. If it were, it's true, we could generate more sales just by running the plant at a faster rate or operating at nearer capacity. But in general, well-run companies maintain a fairly constant turnover ratio, ratio of sales to average assets. Even if it had excess capacity in the plant, the only way it could do more sales would be to carry more inventories and probably to accept carrying more receivables, because if people buy, they don't pay you cash immediately. So at least the current assets would have to go up to support additional sales. And in a reasonable term, even the fixed assets would have to be increased if you want to do more sales. And again, the reason this isn't a perfect assumption is that these asset additions, particularly the fixed assets, are usually made in increments. You don't add 1% to capacity and then another 1% and 1%. You build plants. And if Mr. Lang had his way, you'd build big plants. So you get big steps in capacity additions. And so, yes, this equation falls out of hand every once in a while. But for the most part, it's a reasonable long-term assumption. The second assumption that we have to make in order to develop a limit of growth formula is that most companies maintain a fairly constant asset-to-equity ratio. You recall that the balance sheet says that assets are equal to liabilities plus equity. And if I substituted that for assets, what we're really saying is that a company doesn't borrow money without also putting up additional shareholder money. That is, it keeps its equity and its debt pretty much in balance. And there's a reason for that. If they tried to finance all of their growth by borrowing, adding just liabilities but no equity, then the bondholders or the bankers would begin to take more and more and more of the risk. In fact, at the extreme, if we never put any more equity in the business and just kept borrowing and borrowing, before long we'd have 99% debt and 1% equity. And so essentially all the risk is being taken by the bankers, and they say, well, if we're going to take that risk, we should get the kind of returns that shareholders get. Which means that they either, if they're afraid of the risk, they'll say no to the loan, or if they're going to accept the risk, they're going to demand higher returns on their investment, on the debt. So really don't have much choice. And further, there are sort of artifactual arguments as to why this ratio ought to remain a constant. Bankers are very conservative. And when you walk in and say, I make widgets and I want to borrow money, the first thing they do is pull out their Dun & Bradstreet thing with standard ratios that says, well, widget companies can borrow 30% of their capital and the rest has to be put up in equity. And if you look any different than that, we won't loan you money because you're just too risky. And too risky, that's a code word for, yeah, we'll loan you the money, but it's going to cost you an arm and a leg. Okay? Or another code word for it is, go find a banker that doesn't understand the business and borrow it from him. But sometimes those bankers demand your right arm as security also. So those are the two assumptions we have to make to develop a formula that says something about how fast a business can grow. Now, let's see where we can go for there. We've said so far that the turnover ratio for a company generally is a constant, and that the assets to equity, which you'll recognize as the leverage factor for a company, also remains relatively constant over a reasonable period of time. Okay, now let's see what it takes for the company to grow. Suppose I want to grow the business at a rate of, I don't know, let's make up a number, 15%. What I'm saying is I want sales to go up 15%. But the first formula said that the only way you can grow sales is for assets to grow by an equivalent percentage. That is, the turnover ratio is going to remain a constant. If sales are going to go up 15%, assets are also going to have to rise by 15%. Well, we know where to look for assets. We look on the balance sheet, and oh, lo and behold, here are all the assets on the left-hand side. And what we're saying is if we want the business to grow by 15% a year, the sales, then assets are going to also have to grow by 15%. That's the first step. The second step is we have to find a way to finance those assets. Well, how could we finance them? Well, we can usually use either debt, liabilities, or we can use equity. The second equation said that you can't raise your liabilities unless you also raise the investment of the shareholders. That is, the debt to equity, or better yet, the asset to equity ratio remains a constant. That means the only way assets can go up is for equity to go up also. So if we want to grow 15%, what we're going to have to do is find a way to grow the equity account by 15%. Then we can take on 15% more debt, and everything on the right-hand side of the balance sheet goes up by 15%. Then we got enough money to finance a 15% growth in assets. Where we find ourselves now is that you can't grow any faster than your equity can grow. Because if you can't grow the equity 15%, then you can't take on 15% more debt unless you can violate one of those first assumptions we made and convince the bankers to put up more. And if you can't grow the liabilities or the equity by 15%, you sure as heck are not going to be able to grow the assets. And if you can't grow the assets, you're not going to be able to grow the sales. So in the long run, no company can grow any faster than its assets can grow. And it can no longer grow any faster than its equity will grow. So I guess what we have to do is figure out a way to grow the equity. Now, if you think about it, there's only two ways to increase the equity account. First, we could sell more shares. That would bring in additional equity. And secondly, we could retain more of the profits that we make in the business and grow the equity account by increasing retained earnings. And let's think through the implications of both of these choices. Selling more shares is fairly simple. The nice part about it is you can do it immediately, where if you're going to retain earnings, first you have to make some profits to retain. However, if you go to sell shares, first of all, there are some costs involved. The underwriters want a share of the action. But more significantly, Mr. Gottrox, our principal shareholder, recognizes that unless he's in a position to buy a fixed percentage, the same percentage that he already owns, of the new issue, his control of the business will be diluted by the issuance of new shares. If he presently owns 51% of the stock and we issue another block of stock equal to as many shares as we already have outstanding and he doesn't buy any of it, then his interest is reduced down to something just over 25%. So he's lost control of the business. Now, if he's got the money to buy more shares, fine, but otherwise he loses control. Probably even more importantly than that is if we bring a bunch of new shareholders in, they get to share in all the new profits. So what does Mr. Gottrox actually gain from the growth? Yes, he owns not only a smaller percentage of the business, it's a bigger business, but so what? Now, the so what could still be let's do it if Gottrox happens to also be the president and he's some kind of megalomaniac who likes to earn bigger businesses. You may not make any more money owning the shares, but wouldn't it be great if you could run a bigger business? You might draw a bigger salary at least. Incidentally, that's the answer, of course, to the British system of primogeniture. We run into that problem in family businesses. If mom and pop start a business and they die and they leave the shares to their two children, each kid now owns half the number of shares the parents did. A generation later, you leave your shares to your two kids each. Now four cousins own the business. And in another generation, assuming they just have two kids per generation, you can imagine how much bigger a problem it is if you have sex fiends in the family. You've got eight cousins and then 16 cousins. And before long, we find ourselves in a situation where there's 32 cousins, each of whom owns half as many shares as his parents did, and that's not quite enough to live on the dividend, and God forbid they may have to go to work. Now, there is a way around that. And that is, how about if I run for the job of managing cousin? In other words, I want to be president of the company in addition to being one of the roughly 3% of the stock shareholders, 32 shareholders each earning roughly 3% of the stock. If I could get to be president in addition to my dividend, I'd have the income from the business in the form of a salary. But I need a platform to run on. Now, the politicians in the crowd will recognize that platforms are important. And platforms ought to be based on the aspirations of the people whose votes you need. Well, I don't even have to ask. I know darn well what you cousins want. You want an increase in the dividend so you won't have to go to work. And you know something? That's congruent with my interest, because if you have to go to work, I fear that you're going to go to work for our company. And this cousin over here, who isn't excessively bright, will probably be given the job of pushing a broom, but she'll think that she's as valuable as I am and want the same pay that I get as president. And if I disagree on that, my mother will say, now be nice to your cousin. That's incidentally where family businesses break up and you sell them to the public. But you see, salary is another way to take it out. So megalomaniac Gottrox here, if he owns the business and also runs it, may decide he wants the business to grow just because he can get a bigger salary out of it. But for the most part, growth by issuance of shares is not all that attractive to the present shareholders. It dilutes their interest and really means that all the new profits are going to be spread among all the new shareholders, so you're not really better off in the long run, except for one argument. It's the one that we didn't touch upon when we made the giant leap in logic, and that is that what we're really trying to do, we thought, was grow sales. But, of course, the only reason we want to grow sales is we want earnings to go up. And if it's a leverage business, and this implies that it is, any time that sales go up, you should remember that earnings will go up proportionately more. Because remember, there are fixed costs involved, and when earnings go up, or sales go up, earnings do very well, thank you. But when sales are bad, earnings stink. So there are some arguments for trying to increase sales, even if we don't own a bigger hunk of it, because we're hoping profits will go up faster, which means the value of our shares will rise, even if they were diluted by the issuance of additional stock. Well, back to the problem of how do we grow the equity account. So far, we said that selling new shares is not necessarily the most attractive approach unless Gottrocks, the principal owner, is also the operating manager and wants the business to be bigger because he's a megalomaniac or because he just likes to draw bigger salaries. The other alternative is to grow by retaining earnings in the business. And it's probably the more attractive one if we can convince Gottrocks again, because he's the one who decides through the directors, whether we retain earnings in the business. Each year when we make a profit, the directors decide what to do with it. The choices, you'll recall, are pay a dividend, buy in our stock, or reinvest the money in the business. Now, the principal shareholder, since corporations are not democracies, it's one share, one vote, not one individual, one vote, Mr. 51% back here, will elect the directors, and the directors will damn well do what he wants them to do, although they are exercising their independent judgment. They can exercise it so long as he permits them to be directors, so they will exercise it the way he wants it exercised. No democracy involved. So if Gottrocks wants a dividend, we'll pay it, and if he doesn't want it, it's doubtful that we'll pay it. He'll probably want a little one, because remember we decided that paying dividends qualifies us for inclusions in the widows and orphans accounts and among fiduciaries and helps boost the share value some more. However, the important thing is that we'll only pay a dividend if he wants us to. So indeed, he can control whether we retain earnings. He can't control whether we'll make any money or not, but if we do, he can require us to reinvest most of it. Well, let's suppose we reinvested all of it. We make a certain profit after tax, and we retain all of it. Well, if you think about it, that would mean that the equity account would grow by the ratio of profit after tax divided by equity. For example, if a company had $1 million worth of equity and it earned $100,000 and reinvested all of it, clearly the equity account would grow by 10%. So the ratio of profit after tax to equity is the percentage by which the equity account will grow, assuming we reinvest all of the profit that we make. But you should recognize that profit after tax divided by equity is nothing but return on equity. So now what we've gotten to is that no company can grow any faster than its return on equity. No guarantee they'll grow that fast, and there's some other factors yet to be considered. But the point is, we can't do any better than ROE in the long run. And that's why that ROE measure that we developed in the last lecture in the DuPont formula becomes so important. It's not just a measure of what can we do for, or what have we done for the shareholders. It's also a measure, probably, of what we will be able to do for them in the future in the way of growth. And remember that one of the things they wanted was growth. In fact, probably the most important thing for our rich shareholder, because he likes capital gains. However, companies don't generally retain all of their profits in the business. And that's what limits the return that we can expect to earn. And so the general formula for the limit of growth has to be developed this way. The return on equity times 1 minus the dividend payout, and I suppose I better define dividend payout, that's simply what percentage of the earnings get paid out in dividends each year. So if a company earns $100,000 and pays $20,000 out in dividends, then 20% payout, dividend payout, is the performance. The other 80% is being retained in the business. So whatever percentage we pay out in dividends has to be subtracted from 1 and then multiplied by times the ROE to figure out what we're retaining. So if a company earned a 20% ROE and chose to pay a third of its earnings out in dividends, it would be retaining two-thirds of its earnings, two-thirds of 20%, or about 12 or 13%. And so its growth would be limited to 13% if it paid a third of its 20% ROE out in dividends. However, there's one more factor to consider, and that's that filthy inflation stuff. Because we have to talk about real dollars and not, or constant dollars and not nominal dollars, the way the government does, the reality is that when we talk about growth, we have to subtract the inflation rate out. So if perhaps we're experiencing a 2% inflation rate, we have to subtract that out, and so the real growth in this case would be limited to about 11%. And that's the limit of the formula for the limit of growth. Remember, it's not a guarantee of growth. That's the best we can do. Now, it is true that it compounds itself slightly because, remember, this is the limit of growth on sales. And if we're leveraged, when sales grow, earnings will grow more, which would suggest that ROE will improve, which means we can grow even faster in the future, as long as we don't elect to pay an even bigger percentage of the new earnings out in further larger dividends. As long as we maintain a constant dividend payout rate, we can increase the dividend, but not any faster than earnings grow. Otherwise, we're again limiting our growth rate. Now, I had a client, for example, that earned a very nice return, better than 20% return on equity. But it elected, for all sorts of artifactual reasons, to pay over 80% of its dividend out earnings out in dividends. Well, when you start talking about an 80% dividend payout, that means only 20% of the return is being retained in the business. And so even with a rather good ROE, they can't expect to grow more than 5% a year unless they violate one of the original assumptions we made. That is, they're either going to have to find a way to do a lot more sales, given the assets they have, or they're going to have to issue new stock. Now, you can issue new stock by selling it to the public, but you could also issue it to make an acquisition. In any event, you're issuing shares. And it finds itself faced with that kind of problem. Now, the choices are either find a way to work assets harder, work your assets harder, find a way to cut your dividend, and you know damn well the market won't tolerate that, or at least change the dividend payout policy and don't pay out as big a percentage of any of the new earnings and gradually bring the payout ratio down even though you're not cutting the dividend, or alternatively sell more shares, or you might pray for less inflation, I suppose. I didn't subtract the 2% inflation rate out. In fact, it operates internationally in an environment where the average inflation rate's probably about 4%. We see if you have an 80% payout ratio on a 20% ROE, that means you're only retaining 20% of 20% or 4% in the business, then face a 4% inflation rate, you don't have any growth in the real terms unless you do something magnificent. Now, there are some magnificent things you can do. One of them, of course, is find a way to work your assets harder. One of the approaches to that I alluded to in an earlier talk, and that is take a hard look at what assets you're using and use them harder. One of the places that many firms find opportunities is in working capital. It turns out that most firms have too much money tied up in inventory. They don't enforce their collection policy on receivables, so they have too much money tied up in receivables. And they pay too fast. And so I don't want to suggest that, or my present employers might not pay me as fast as I'd like. They pay faster than they have to, and so they're not using their payables correctly. That is, they're not using financing from their suppliers. And so I have an idea. Let's make these intermediate managers work harder on this subject. How do we get them interested? Because remember, down at the division level, the way things are financed is not supposed to be any of their business. They're only supposed to do with the assets as best they can do. Well, how about if we charge you a fee for the use of working capital from now on, you subordinate managers? And a real steep one at that. I suggest a fee equal to our cost of capital. Now you see that's going to come out of your bottom line, reducing the ROA you can claim you had. And the price you'll pay is that your bonus will be hurt unless you figure out a way to use less working capital. Well, corporations play that game, incidentally, with subsidiaries all the time. The worst one is in how they allocate overheads. Overhead is, of course, the general term that business people use for all the costs they don't choose to actually identify to a particular task. Instead, they lump them together and allocate it in some way and say, you've got to pay so much overhead, and so do you, and so do you. And they try to find an easy way to do it because accountants like easy ways. I'm very sensitive to the subject of overhead because I had once had a very big fight with the president of my institution while I was serving as dean as to how I was as dean to pay for the overhead of space that I used. And the university had a very simple system. It sounded good on its face. You, the dean, would pay for a percentage of all the space costs of the university based on the number of credit hours you taught. So if you taught 10% of the students, you'd pay for 10% of the space cost. If you had 20% of the students, you'd pay for 20%. Very simple system, easy to understand. Even presidents can understand it. The only trouble is it's a damned ripoff. Because you see, as a business dean, I shove 90 people in front of a professor in the same room, and he teaches 90 people. The dean for the School for the Arts puts one cello player in there to rehearse and pays 1/90th what I pay for the same space. Now, you see, what that really means is I'm subsidizing the School for the Arts. I'm paying more for the space than he is. And School for the Arts is, you know, damn good school. In fact, I like the arts, so I was perfectly willing to subsidize it, provided that I get credit for the subsidy. The president isn't about to give us any credit for that. So overhead allocation is one of the ways that you really stick your subordinates. And the new one is working capital fees. Every department will now suddenly become aware of profits because we're going to charge them through the nose for working capital. Well, how else can we grow? Because it's clear that there's a limit to what we can do just playing the finance game. Well, I suggested that selling new stock might be the answer. The trouble is, if I simply sell new stock, I've got to put that money to work. And, of course, Mr. Gottrocks has to be convinced it's worth the dilution he has to realize or will realize if I sell shares and he doesn't prepare to put more money up. And so what I'm going to have to do is figure out a way to invest in new investments and pay for it with shares. And maybe what I have to do is learn to play the price-to-earnings game, the P.E. game. The stock market, in its infinite wisdom or lack of it, likes to talk about the price-to-earnings ratios of shares. Basically, the argument is that a stock ought to sell at some reasonable price compared to the earnings per share that it generates. And the folk wisdom, and that's all it is that the price-to-earnings ratio of a company probably ought to equal its growth rate. In other words, if you run a 20% growth company, your stock ought to sell at 20 times earnings. And if this turkey over here only runs a 10% growth company, his company ought to only sell at 10 times earnings. And if your business runs at 15 times earnings, or 15% growth, you're entitled to a 15-to-1 P.E. ratio. Well, let's suppose we're a 20% growth company, but we're having trouble figuring out how to continue to grow at that rate. But as long as we're a 20% growth company and the market hasn't noticed that we have run out of opportunities for internal financing, then with a 20% growth rate, we're entitled to a 20-to-1 P.E. ratio. Let's go out and find us somebody to buy with shares. I suggest that we buy somebody who sells at a lower P.E. ratio. Like, how about 10-to-1? Now, you see, that means I'm going to issue shares that the market values at 20 times earnings and buy a stock where I only have to pay 10 times earnings to buy it. I bring those earnings aboard, and if the market hasn't paid close attention, those additional earnings are attributed a 20-to-1 ratio. So earnings that I bought at 10 times earnings suddenly are worth 20 times earnings. Hey, that's pretty good stuff if you think about it. Not only that, clearly I'm a growth company, maybe growing faster than 20% because look at that big spurt. Well, if I'm a growth company, I maybe ought to be entitled to a 30 times multiple. So the whole business ought to be valued at 30 times earnings. Now, that's pretty great as long as the analysts come out of better business schools and don't understand this. You know, on Wall Street, and so they think we're a growth company. And it's pretty great until the end of next year when suddenly they discover that business we acquired wasn't a growth company, and so our earnings are not growing at the pace that they thought they would grow. Yes, they took that one-time jump when we acquired Turkey's company, but now they're not growing. I've got an idea. As long as we're a 30-to-1 P.E. ratio company, let's go buy that 20-to-1 company and put that in our stable. We're a growth company again. We ought to be worth 40 times earnings. And besides, we bought these at 20, and the market says we're worth 30 times earnings, so we've got that growth. But you see, when you get on that merry-go-round, there's no getting off. Because I'm not going to get the growth out of the growth of these new companies, unless, of course, I have a big enough ego to think that when I take you guys over and start kicking butts and showing you how to run your company, that you'll grow appropriately. If you have underutilized assets or you're not exploiting the markets the way you would, given our senior management team, you should certainly improve your performance. The reality, of course, is that when you take a new company under your wing, there's all sorts of cultural problems, and if anything, earnings will drop off for a while. In fact, the one guy who was worth anything, who was running this company, as soon as he gets enough money for his business, is going to quit and take off anyway. Well, that's a good time to offer them this consulting contract so they have to stay on as part of the deal instead of just shares. Keeps the goodwill off the books, and more significantly, it keeps him or her around to help run the business. Of course, we don't offer it to the other turkeys in the business who aren't worth keeping. The other advantage acquiring with stock is that there's no discussion of putting goodwill in the books because we're acquiring with shares rather than with money. Further, there's no limit to what we can acquire as long as we can run the printing press. That's almost as good as being the Federal Reserve System, isn't it? Or the government. The government needs money, they just go to the government printing office and print some. Well, wouldn't it be neat if we could acquire any business we want just by turning on the printing press and printing shares? If you're dumb enough to take them, I can buy your business. Not only that, when we offer to acquire your company this way, we're really doing you a big favor. Because remember, if we acquired the business for cash, you would have to admit to the capital gain that you had realized in selling your shares to us and immediately pay the capital gain tax. But if we offer you shares, that's not a taxable event. The share exchange doesn't get taxed until you sell the shares that you just bought, or received, rather. You see that? So what we're really saying is we're doing you a big favor by offering you these phony shares we've printed. Well, they're not necessarily phony, but the new shares that we've printed, because it means it's not a taxable event. Very often, by the time you get around to selling your company, you're as old as I am, which means you have to be planning your estate for your death. And you see, if you hold on to these new shares long enough, you can die with them in your estate and leave them to your kid, and there's no capital gain tax on it again. So there's all sorts of arguments for playing the game by acquisition with shares, and we call it the PE game. But the problem is, if you get on the merry-go-round, there's no way off. A lot of companies are playing this game. It's fashionable to do it. You can generally tell when it's getting out of hand, and that's when companies begin to acquire businesses they don't know anything about. We called that conglomerates, you may recall, back in the early 80s, late 70s and early 80s. At one time, the argument was that a company ought to grow by acquiring businesses that integrate well into activity. If you think about it, the only viable strategies there are for a business are either A, they can integrate backward and try to take over some of the functions that their suppliers used to do and capture the margins that those suppliers generated. Be a captive customer to their own raw materials. Another possibility is to integrate forward towards the market and take over the business that your customers used to do and try to capture their margins. So maybe instead of selling to wholesalers who then sell to retailers, we could become a wholesaler. And we'd sell to our wholesale division, which in turn would sell to retailers, and we would recapture the profits that were normally made by wholesalers. That's not illogical. We could also integrate or grow by diversifying in things that are related. And that's not too far-fetched. If we're already distributing product to supermarkets, widgets, maybe we can distribute combs or pens or cans of soup or something else and make better use of the distribution process or something of this sort. We might grow by putting more products into our line that fit in our present manufacturing capability, especially if we have excess capacity. We might grow by making better use of our byproducts than we're presently using. If we can't get somebody else to build the byproduct plant that we talked about that we wanted built next to a refinery, maybe we should build it. So there are all sorts of logical ways to grow, but if we're in the widget business, does it make a heck of a lot of sense for us to get into pharmaceuticals? Well, for people with very big egos, they would simply argue back in the days of conglomerates, well, I can run anything successfully. So what I'm really bringing to this association, to this merger, is my genius. I know how to make money in widgets, so I damn well know how to make money in cancer cures. And I can certainly make money as a professional service business or whatever, so I ought to buy an accounting firm, I guess. And so you got some rather strange bedfellows, and in fact, In time, those things sort of fell apart. Very few conglomerates ever worked. There are occasional geniuses that come along that can, in fact, do it all. But beware of investing in businesses like that. Well, where have we been? So far, we've said that there are, in fact, limits to how fast a business can grow, and the shareholders demand growth. But they're a little bit, maybe the appropriate term is schizophrenic. They want two things out of it. They talk out of both sides of their mouth. They want growth, but they also want dividends. And the two are not unrelated. Yes, it's true that dividends may actually help us grow if it qualifies our shares for inclusion in other portfolios. But it's also true that any time we make a dividend payout, we are limiting our growth because the limit of growth formula says that the dividend payout limits the growth. Another possibility, of course, is to try to find some place where there's no inflation or maybe lobby against inflation. But I haven't heard any of corporations getting ahead by screaming at Washington that for a change we ought to stop causing inflation. You understand that, we've said this before, it's very often in government's interest to see inflation because they're the biggest debtors, and debtors gain from inflation because it means they can repay with phony money that doesn't buy anything later on. So effectively, they're just taxing the money away. But we can't do much about inflation except maybe dodge it by going to a geographic area where the inflation isn't so bad. Alternative, we can build the ROE, and that's maybe not as hard as it seems because, remember, if it's a leverage business, if we grow sales, we can also expect earnings to grow even faster because of the leveraging effect. We can violate the rules involved here. That is, we can look for ways to increase the sales-to-asset ratio, the turnover ratio. One that we suggested is simply using the assets better. Another is to kick butts among the subordinate managers by convincing them that they better handle the current assets better, the working capital, and that's by charging them a lot for it. There is another approach. How about if we stop doing things? What if we subcontract everything? If we can get somebody else to make the asset investment, we can produce more product, and then the only asset investment we'll have to make is probably in finished goods inventory, and in receivables if we're financing the sale of the product. But it means we don't need plant and equipment investment, and we don't need raw material inventories, and we don't need work in process inventories. That's a big start towards doing more sales with fewer assets, which would improve the turnover ratio, the sales to average assets ratio. We might take another look at the asset to equity ratio. Are we indeed financing the business appropriately? Remember that if we can improve sales, and we expect earnings to improve even more, bankers love companies whose earnings are improving. Remember that bankers look at the risk involved in making a loan, and one of their measures of risk is what coverage we have of the interest and principal that has to be paid. Well, if our earnings go up, we have more coverage, so clearly we're a safer business and entitled to lower interest rates. Even if the banker doesn't decide that, the bond rating companies will. And so instead of a double A rating, we'll get a triple A rating, and we'll be able to borrow at 8% instead of 9%. So the cost of money goes down. The interesting thing about a drop in the cost of money is if the cost of capital drops, we can say yes to projects that we used to have to reject. Because remember, we said that when we evaluated proposals involving discounting future cash flows, we discounted at a rate that reflected our cost of capital. And so if we have a lower cost of capital, because we have a higher rated bond, then we can borrow cheaper, our cost of capital comes down, and we can say yes to a 9% project, where in the past maybe we could only say yes to a project of 10%. That means more projects are available. And finally, we have to recognize that some projects pay off not just because the project is a payoff, but because it generates other opportunities, or it allows us to utilize some other asset more efficiently. In some cases, we sell product not because there's money in it, but because it keeps our competitors out. If you walk along the shelves of a supermarket, you'll see all sorts of things that don't sell all that well, but the big guys produce them because that takes shelf space, and if that shelf space is occupied, it's not available to a competitor. Now, in the next lecture, in fact, the next two lectures, we're going to be looking at the strategic signatures case, and it would probably be worth your time to make a little investment in this before you turn on the tape. We're going to be looking at a set of financials for 10 companies, all of which you'll recognize. They're major U.S. companies. However, I'll tell you in advance, you've got the financials for all 10, but you're not told which set of financials belongs to which company, and your job is to figure out how they match. If the accountants did a good job of taking the picture, then when you understand the business, you ought to recognize it when you see it. Now, the way to approach this is to look at each of the 10 companies on the front page and decide, how would you make a buck in the business? Ask yourself, what do you have to do well, and what do you have to avoid to succeed in that business? And that will tell you a lot about what the balance sheet ought to look like and what the income results ought to look like. And if the accountants agreed with you, you'll be able to tell which guy is which, and that's how we're going to do it.